I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Charisse Davids is not your typical Kansas politician, but maybe that's why she's proving to be so popular. Some recent polls, in fact, have her leading Republican rival and incumbent, Representative Kevin Yoder. Today, we'll sit down with a surging challenger and ask her which priorities she'd take with her if Kansans sent her to Washington. Then, it's beginning to look a lot like Halloween. To get you in a spooky mood, we've got the cinephiles here, and we're going to talk about vampires in film. The story has intrigued movie audiences for nearly 100 years. We'll find out what makes them so terrifying and so appealing. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Charisse Davids is giving Republican Congressman Kevin Yoder a run for his money in Kansas's 3rd District. She's a lawyer and a graduate of Johnson County Community College who went on to Cornell Law School and became a White House fellow. If she wins, she would be the first female Native American member of Congress and the first openly gay member of the Kansas delegation. She's the daughter of a single mother Army veteran, and she's right here, right now in our studios. And Charisse, welcome back. Nice to have you here.
Oh, yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Why are you running for the U.S. House of Representatives? Why do you want this job?
You know, I think there were a lot of us in the last few years that realized that we weren't being represented very well in Congress and, frankly, by the leadership of our federal government. And, you know, like a lot of people, I found myself wondering, you know, what can I do about this? And as someone, I mean, you already mentioned it, as someone who went from Johns County Community College to Cornell for law school and a first-generation college student, someone who worked my way through school, I didn't feel like I saw enough of kind of our experiences being represented by the people who are making decisions that affect every single one of us. And, you know, I wanted to do something about that, and I have not felt like Kevin Yoder's done a good job of representing our community in Congress, and just had to do something about it.
How so? I mean, where has Kevin Yoder, in your estimation, Charisse, fallen short?
Well, there's probably quite a few things I can talk about, but you know, the big ticket items I would say are. You know, he takes a lot of money from special interests and has turned around and frankly, advocated for them and voted in ways that have really supported the agenda of a lot of other people.
What's an example of that? What have you seen?
Well, you know, the biggest thing that I have heard from people on and that I've seen myself is on healthcare. You know, telling people that he is, you know, a champion for our health care feels misleading when he voted 19 times to eliminate protections for folks with pre-existing conditions. And, you know, that is something that I hear about so often because people are worried about losing their health care coverage.
Yeah. Is another vote that he's taken that just really got under your skin? You saw the vote and thought, I've got to run for Congress.
You know, I would say supporting the like Wall Street and big, you know, big money interests. Mm-hmm. That's something that really, you know, I was raised by a single mom, and you know, she had to work really hard to take care of her three kids, and that extra wiggle room that you have from you know, depending on how much taxes you're paying, to see Kevin Yoder support a tax bill that really benefited the most wealthy in our country. Yeah. and financial industry and Wall Street when hardworking people are struggling, is that's definitely something that you know, when I think about why we need different representatives in Congress, that's the kind of stuff I'm thinking about.
Democrat Charisse David, she's a candidate for Congress in Kansas's 3rd District. She's my guest here. What's the one thing you most want to accomplish in Congress? What are you going there to get done?
I'd say there's a couple of things. One is making sure that, you know, the health of our community is being advocated for. And that means making sure that we're moving toward affordable quality health care and access to that for everyone. And one of the things that I think we can do to help address that is to get big money out of politics. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that we've really been talking to folks a lot about lately is how do we get big money out of this this political arena, because it should not be this expensive to participate in our democracy.
But you're raising big money. You're getting a lot of money right now. How are you going to ensure that you're not being unduly influenced by the checks that have been coming in to Charisse Davids for Congress?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question, because certainly we have raised a large sum of money, but when you really dig into the numbers we're putting up, one of the things that I'm most proud of is that right now we're sitting at around a $35 average contribution size, which means there's a lot of people who are supporting this campaign. You know, $2.7 million in the last quarter. Spread out over $35 average contribution size it's just a lot of people. 96% of the money that that has been contributed to this campaign is small dollar donors, so that's under $200. And I think that is actually kind of the answer to how we get these large interests out of having so much influence is by really democratizing the way that our campaigns are funded.
Yeah.
But I don't think that it should cost this much money for people to run for office.
Hey, does all this feel a little surreal to you? You know, you just got in the race, you know, a few months ago, and here you are on the brink, perhaps, of winning a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. Your head has got to be spinning a little bit.
Surreal is definitely something that I have used to describe this experience.
That sounds pretty accurate to you, eh?
Yeah. You know, we got in the race in February, in the middle of February, and it has been nonstop. You know, it's been, we always joke that it's a marathon sprint, and that, you know, the learning curve for doing this is pretty steep, and especially going up now in the general against an incumbent who's been serving for, you know, he's gone through this 4 times mm-hmm. on the congressional level and before that at the state house level. And so the learning curve is certainly steep, but, you know, I'm lucky to have the kind of unique path that I've had. There's been lots of times in my life, you know, I know I already mentioned this, but going from community college as a first-generation college student to Cornell for law school and then on to the White House Fellowship
right.
has it's helped me adapt quickly and learn new skills. And I think that's really coming in handy here.
Charisse Davids, again, is my guest. What do you think of President Trump's performance so far? How would you describe it?
Well,
if you had to give him a grade, what do you give him?
Oh, a grade.
You're a former student. You know about grades. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Man, I'd probably, he'd probably be glad we weren't grading on a pass-fail system here. you know, I think that the biggest concern I have about the performance of the president has been just what I would call a chaotic approach to almost every single issue I've seen him take action or not take action on.
Mm-hmm.
He's unpredictable in a way that is, you know, just it's not good for us to have someone who heads up the executive side of our government to be unpredictable, to be to take an approach that often like defies logic.
Mm-hmm.
And I I think that he has just, he's put out a lot of rhetoric that is not helpful. He's,
You know, you speak often of the need for change in politics and government, and I'm wondering, is it time to change leaders in the Democratic caucus? You know, would you vote for Nancy Pelosi as speaker if you won a seat here?
Yeah, well, I do talk about change a lot because I really think that we're at this time, we're in this time in history where we're seeing that continuing down the same road is not going to benefit the people. And, you know, certainly Washington is, I mean, Washington seems to be broken, you know, and that is the fault of the leadership of both parties. You know, they should be taking responsibility for the role that they've played in the lack of action that we're seeing from our Congress. And I want to see leadership that's taking us, that's gonna have a plan for how we're gonna move away from this hyper-partisan politics and political gamesmanship on almost every single issue.
So you want new leadership in the House Democratic Caucus?
I want new leadership across the board, because I think that I just think the leadership of both parties can, I just want to see people who are coming out with plans for how we're going to get stuff done in D.C.
So you wouldn't vote for Nancy Pelosi again as the Democratic leader?
Well, I'm not going to vote for anybody who doesn't lay out a clear plan for what we need to do to break away from the inaction in Congress and the dysfunction.
Does that suggest you could vote for Nancy Pelosi again if she lays out that clear plan?
Yeah, I think we need leadership that's going to do something different than what we've seen.
Okay. Congressman Yoder has criticized you repeatedly, actually, in recent weeks for not showing up to debates. In fairness, I should point out he didn't debate his opponents in past election cycles either. I'm just wondering, will you debate him here on Up to Date between now and the election?
Well, I have agreed to KC Starr televised debate
with Fox 4
on October 29th. Mm-hmm. Correct me if I'm wrong on that date, but on October 29th, I think we're still waiting to hear back on whether that's going to happen or not. And certainly I would be open to the idea of us being able to do it here. My preference would be that we do it as a televised debate. And
you could do more than one.
Yeah. And so I hope that we can do that televised debate, but would definitely be open to coming on.
If you're elected, how are you going to stay in touch with your constituents? What process are you going to put in place to make sure that you're not losing touch with the folks back home?
Yeah, I've had some time to think about that because, you know, I think that this whole process of running for office and campaigning certainly gives you insight into how many people feel like they haven't been heard, how many people feel like they haven't had a chance to talk to their current representative. And so, you know, some of the immediate things I can talk about are holding town halls and making sure to be available in district, you know, when business isn't being conducted in D.C., making sure to be available in district to meet with constituents. I've actually been meeting with a lot of folks who have told me that, you know, they don't expect to talk to Kevin Yoder every single time, but that, you know, when teachers want to meet with their representative and have been trying to get meetings with him and aren't able to, there's a problem there. And so, you know, just making myself available is, I think, going to be a huge and stark difference between what we've had before and what I want to offer.
You know, one thing I'm wondering is, what are you going to do if your constituents are saying they want Sharice Davids to vote one way, but your party has taken a firm position on the other side of the ledger for that particular issue? How are you going to weigh that out? What are you going to do?
Well, I mean, the party isn't the reason that I got elected. You know, it's because of the people in the district. And I think the role of a representative is to do just that, is to represent and reflect the voices of the people, you know, of the community that elected that person to office. And that's exactly what I want to be, and what I'm striving toward is to win this election so that I can take our community's voice to D.C., because I just don't think we've had that.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our guest, Charisse Davids, the candidate for Congress in Kansas's 3rd District, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Charisse, the Star had a story today pointing out that more than 2 years after a South Dakota judge ordered your failed coffee company to repay investors about $20,000, those investors still haven't been paid. I'm wondering where that stands and what happened there.
Yeah, well, I saw the article this morning for sure and read through there, and I thought the article did a pretty good job of laying out the circumstances and you know, giving a little bit of background on Hoka Coffee Company, and which is a LLC. And
what was your position there?
And I was one of the I was the sole owner, but I was the, you know, there was a came out of an idea that a group of us had to just try to, you know, like a lot of people know how it is to try to start a small business,
right.
You know, and so Hoka Coffee Company had a small business loan from a venture capital firm, you know, and that's pretty typical for a venture capital firm to help out with a small emerging business. And,
yeah.
You know, and I think that one of the more interesting pieces, well, my favorite line out of there was something about my unique career path, because I think that this understanding of the role of venture capital, the role of startup businesses, and, you know, I often talk about how Kansas City, the whole metro area, has this entrepreneurship is kind of baked into the DNA
uh-huh.
of this place.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's one of the reasons that I know how important it'll be as a representative or a member of Congress to be as strong a support system and work to make sure that those folks who are trying to start small businesses and trying to have access to capital and get the support they need to contribute to our economy. I know how important that is, and I'm looking forward to trying to help other people make that a reality.
Is that on you to repay that money, and do you plan to do it?
No, so the loan was actually between Hoka Coffee Company and the venture capital firm, you know, and that was actually one of the things I really appreciated about the article, too, is
mm-hmm.
Just helping folks see that, you know, an LLC is a company, and the whole purpose of using an LLC as an entity form to start a small business is to be able to make sure that, you know, individuals are not liable or, you know, responsible for debts of a company.
Again, our phone number, 816-235-2888 is our number here, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. For Charisse Davids, Richard from Green Valley. Richard, you're on the air.
Yes, the question I have for your candidate, and I think this speaks across the board, not just in her district, but in regards to American politics today, is what can and should we do with regard to unregistered dark money that comes in that is essentially skewing the votes one way or another, and there's no accountability on this.
What are you going to do about dark money? I think Richard's asking, Charisse, what can be done?
Yeah, well, thanks, Richard, for calling in and asking that question, because the concept of dark money and big money in politics is it's very concerning. And, you know, as somebody who, I mean, I came from a family that really, I mean, we didn't have money, so I don't have access to a large network of people that have a ton of money. And so I feel like there are a lot of folks who fit in that category that are acutely aware of how, mm-hmm. You know, how this is actually a barrier to electing people who are who have more similar experiences to most of us. And I think that one of the things that we have to do, and part of why I'm so proud to be endorsed by InCitizens United, is to we have to increase the transparency of who is putting money into these super PACs. And then, you know, just really try to figure out ways to make sure that individuals are participating in our democratic process, rather than just corporations. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that corporations have free speech in the same way that an individual does cuts against the idea that individuals are participating in our democracy. So I think that increasing the transparency and figuring out ways to make sure that we don't continue to allow these very large interests to put in unlimited amounts of money into super PACs.
You know, you got in some hot waters, a different topic, earlier in the campaign when you appeared to say you wanted to abolish ICE. That's the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. Do you want to abolish ICE? Can you clarify that for us?
No, I don't want to abolish ICE. I don't support abolishing ICE. I do want us to have a bipartisan comprehensive immigration reform, and
including a path to citizenship.
Yeah, path to citizenship, and then I'll mention really quickly that Dreamers, certainly we should be making sure that we're protecting Dreamers and getting them a pathway to citizenship. But I think we just are seeing, for too long, we've seen inaction on this issue. Our immigration system is broken, and it has been for a long time. And, you know, I feel like it was not that many years ago that it seemed as though we might see some bipartisan movement on this issue.
Right.
And then, like too many other things, this hyper-partisanship that we've seen just increase over the years has really put that at a stalemate. And
well, the president is saying, as you know, that there's not going to be an immigration bill unless it includes that wall along the border with Mexico. Can you support a bill that includes the wall along the southern border?
I don't support a wall. I don't support building a wall. I don't think that that's a good use of resources. I also think, it's not an answer to some of the issues that we should be thinking about. And I think that earlier when you asked me what I thought about the job that the president is doing, this concept of, being a bit chaotic and illogical in his approach to problem solving, building a wall feels like it feels like that kind of knee-jerk reaction that we see out of him a lot.
You know, you say on your website that you want to push for a middle-class tax cut. And I'm wondering, would that be on top of the tax cut that passed earlier this year? Where do you come down there?
The tax cut that passed earlier this year is... It benefited so much the very wealthy, and it put additional burdens on folks that, when I think about the burden it put on folks who are teachers, you know, when you think about the amount, first of all, teachers aren't paid enough. Public school teachers are not paid enough. And then the fact that they can no longer take deductions for the school supplies that they're buying, that they're taking to their classrooms to help teach the children that are in their care.
Although the personal deduction has increased dramatically.
I still think that there's so many aspects of that tax bill that really were disproportionately beneficial for the very, very wealthy and mm-hmm. corporations. And
so you think on top of that, then there's a need for a middle class tax cut?
I think that there's a need for definitely for taking care of the middle class, a tax cut for the middle class, but not on top of giving. I don't think that the very wealthiest among us and, the very wealthy corporate shareholders that are seeing tax benefits should continue to see these benefits on, you know, on the hard work of so many middle class people in this country.
So are you saying would you want to redo that first tax cut bill if you're a member of Congress, reconsider it?
Yeah, I think we should. Mm-hmm. I definitely think we should be reconsidering it, amending it, and or coming up with a new plan.
Okay. Just one final point. If you go with a middle-class tax cut, this week came the news that the deficit had reached $779 billion. That's a six-year high, nearly 17% higher year over year from 2017. Mm-hmm. If you push for another tax cut, it might add to that deficit. And would you be willing to do that?
You know, I think one of the things that's been so unfortunate about the conversation around the deficit and you know, the role that the tax cut has played in it is that we continue to see, you know, the leadership of, frankly, of the Republican Party talking about that deficit being the fault of programs that hardworking people have been paying into for their entire career.
Medicare, Social Security.
Yeah. Instead of looking to these massive tax cuts that the very wealthy and large corporate tax cuts that we've seen, those are the places that we really need to be looking at when we try to figure out how we should address the deficit.
We're going to have to leave our conversation there. That's Charisse David. She's a Democrat. She's running for Kansas's 3rd congressional district seat, and she is an opponent of Republican Kevin Yoder. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Appreciate
it. Good to talk to you again.
Okay, Charisse. Still ahead, a perpetual theme for Halloween and for film, vampires. The cinephiles will bring us some classic examples from the movies. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Next week on the show, we've got a great lineup for you. We'll discuss some upcoming ballot issues to keep you informed. We'll sit down with the new fire chief of Kansas City, Kansas. And for a little fun, we'll meet a man who's creating a golf course in the urban Ivanhoe neighborhood. That's next week on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, what is it about vampires that continues to fascinate? What is it about vampires that continues to dominate popular culture? Well, here's one answer. They're cool. They're glamorous and sexual and even grotesque. And maybe they're real, as we're about to explain. The cinephiles are back in the house to talk about vampire films and the enduring popularity of good folks like Dracula. With us once again, the cinephiles. Mitch Bryan's a screenwriter and UMKC film professor. Mitch, nice to have you.
Great to be here.
Aaron Hammerbeck's also back. She's a screenwriter who teaches at the Kansas City Art Institute and UMKC. Good to have you, Aaron.
Thanks.
And we should point out we're listening to the theme from the 1992 film Bram Stoker's Dracula. You know, Mitch, you have an enduring interest in all things vampire. In fact, you've written a new adaptation of Bram Stoker's Dracula called A Song of Love and Death that's now playing at the Spencer Theater on campus. I'll talk more about it in a few minutes, but tell us about that.
I think that this idea of the vampire is this archetype that we're able to refigure and transform from generation to generation. And so what concerns us or fascinates us about the vampire in, let's say, the 1930s might be very, very different than something from the 50s or something from the 80s or today. And so that is one of the things about an archetype that's so fascinating is it's constantly shifting and changing.
Aaron, what fascinates you so much about vampires?
I think it's some of the same thing. You know, they live for generations. They have so, you know, that they have all these historical references. And there's something kind of tragic about that, too. So they've got all these, contrasting traits. Like you mentioned, they're glamorous and grotesque at the same time.
You know, you say vampires, Aaron, are cool, glamorous, sexual, and grotesque. I mean, tell us how you really feel here.
I mean, they're all of those things. I remember when American Horror Story they took on vampires. You know, they had Lady Gaga and they had, you know, these beautiful people playing vampires. And, you know, you still had all the blood and guts and gore. And so I love that contradiction of beauty and horror.
You know, Mitch, you also insist, and this is interesting to me, that vampires are real. We encounter them, most of us, in our daily lives. What are you talking about?
Well, have you ever met somebody that after you've spent a few minutes with them feel like they've taken all of your energy away?
Yeah,
they've taken your focus away.
Yes.
And so in that sense, the vampire as predator or the vampire as, you know, life sucker is sort of real, you know? And I think that with Dracula, that's one of the alluring things about that novel is that Dracula comes into this system of friendship and happiness, and he just ruins it, you know, to the point where they have to come together and fight him. These people who love each other, they have to come up against this creature that's really driven by hate and destruction.
Yeah, how well, just in general, Aaron, has Hollywood done when it comes to, you know, vampire movies? Has that been a pretty successful kind of genre for Hollywood? Have they handled it pretty well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we found out that there's, 170 adaptations or movies where Dracula is featured.
170.
I mean, that's how popular and iconic and timeless this subject is for people. I mean, you know, I think that, you know, when we think of vampires, we definitely have a very specific image in our minds. And it's almost this trope in society. We know exactly what vampires look like, and they're so iconic.
You know, when we talk about, Mitch, you know, Frankenstein and the werewolf and Dracula, is Dracula sort of the star among those three, or is it hard to say?
It's kind of hard to say, but if there have been 170 versions of Dracula, there have not been 170 versions of Frankenstein or Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So there is something enduring about Dracula and what he represents to from one generation to the next, including the big Broadway revival in early 1980s with Frank Langella, was all played for camp. So you can have a lot of fun with the idea of the vampire too, because it's so deeply ingrained, you know, as an archetype.
Yeah. We're going to talk about some movies in just a moment, but I want to point out that Dracula, A Song of Love and Death by Mitch Bryan, will be running through Sunday at Spencer Theater on the UMKC campus. It's a co-production with UMKC Theater. Mitch, let's go to Near Dark from 1987. It tells the story of a young man who meets a beautiful woman on a summer night and finds himself unwillingly taken in by her family of vampires preying on people across the Southwest. Why not?
So this is an amazing movie directed by Catherine Bigelow, who would go on to make The Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty and Point Break. And it's this amazing 1980s mishmash of genres. It's a vampire film. It's a lovers on the run film. It's a crime film. It's an action film. And it's a Western. And it features this amazing cast of characters, several of whom had just finished doing James Cameron's Aliens and then came over to do Near Dark with Bigelow. And it was made very independently and inexpensively. And Dila De Laurentiis, who was distributing it, went under the week that they were ready to release it. So the film suddenly got dumped onto the market. Nobody saw it. And it's one of those films that now has found this cult following all these years later.
Was this Catherine Bigelow's first film on the road to a very successful career?
She had made a film called The Loveless before that was sort of everybody missed. And I think she even maybe co-directed that. So this was her first big splashy entrance into the film world. And she really, you know, distinguished herself as a premier director of action scenes.
And you're saying Near Dark is worth seeing.
Absolutely. You can't miss it. It's really worth seeing.
We have a clip here from Near Dark. What is it?
They're debating the fate of this young guy who's been taken into this group of outlaw vampires.
Okay.
Look, I'll take care of him.
You can't, May. I churned you. I taught you.
Well, I turned him and I'll teach him.
What's the matter, Homer? You jealous? A little too little to be jealous.
Have any idea what it's like to be a big man on the inside and have a small body on the outside?
You have any idea what it's like to hear about it every night?
We want to give him a week. Then it's decided. We give him a week to see if we can call him one of us.
You know, I'm really struck by the fact that this film it's got a little Bonnie and Clyde in here. You say it's got a little Western in it. This is a vampire movie?
And they never say the word vampire.
Oh, really?
There's an incredible shootout where the Kansas Highway Patrol have them surrounded in a hotel room, and they start blasting away at the walls. Well, bullets don't hurt vampires, but it's early in the morning, so every bullet hole is followed by a shaft of daylight which if that hits the vampires, it's, you know, it's going to burn them up. And it's, so it's that kind of really inventive, you know, crossbreeding of the action film and the horror film that makes this so interesting.
And this thing's got actually has a cult following that's picked up on it because you say it sort of crashed and burned when it was released.
Yeah, it's one of the, it's still not seen as much as a lot of these other vampire movies, but it has a very dedicated following and is really worth seeking out.
Aaron, have you seen this thing?
I haven't yet.
It sounds like you need to.
Yes, I absolutely do. Yeah, it sounds exciting.
Okay, that first film, Near Dark, and if our listeners want to chime in here with some recommendations for their favorite vampire films, 816-235-2888 is our number here, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's move on to your first film here, Aaron. It's titled Twilight. It's Bella Swan moves to Forks, wherever that is, and encounters Edward Cullen, a gorgeous boy with a secret.
Yeah. This movie is actually, I think, being re-released for its 10-year anniversary. I think that, you know, typically speaking, romance movies, romance literature, they tend to have to clamor for legitimacy. And because it's dealing with the source material, the screenplay was adapted by Melissa Rosenberg from the very popular book by Stephanie Meyer. I think that it tends to get this eye roll from people. And it's, you know, it is what it is. It's a teenage romance movie that involves vampires, and it's fun and silly, and it's got a fantastic soundtrack to it. So, you know, I think that a lot of times people think, oh, well, it's because it's a part of the Twilight series books that it's not as good. But I mean, Catherine Hardwicke was an indie film director. And if you watch it thinking that it's an indie film, I think that you'll enjoy it more.
You know, again, this film was harangued a whole lot, and maybe because it was based off of the Twilight series books, and you're saying maybe that was a little unfair?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, because of the enormous success of this first film, Catherine Hardwicke was taken off of the project, and all of the subsequent films were directed by men that were, you know, had these enormous Hollywood careers, and they're just not as good. I mean, the way she directs it, it has all of that ambiance of this, you know, this misty Forks, you know, that's dark and cold and dreary. And then it also has all of that teenage awkwardness that you want from like a teenage love story.
I've also read that this film offers some bad relationship advice it gives to girls. And that was one other reason it was criticized so much. Do you recall an example of what the bad relationship advice was?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that you should, you know, fall in love with vampires.
Yeah.
So step one. And then
a little tip there to naive out there.
To the audiences. Yeah, out there. You know, I honestly don't know that really any romance film features a healthy, communicative relationship where, you know, there are no power struggles. Everyone is you know, responsible. And, and you know, I think that's kind of what a romance movie is. It's messy and it's real and it's raw.
We have a clip here from this film, Twilight. What is it, Aaron?
So this is when Bella has figured out that Edward is a vampire, and she's confronting him about it.
Okay, this is from Twilight from 2008.
You're impossibly fast and strong. Your skin is pale white and ice cold. Your eyes change color. And sometimes you speak like you're from a different time. You never eat or drink anything. You don't go out in the sunlight. How old are you?
17.
How long have you been 17?
A while.
Very long while.
Yeah,
yes.
a very, very long while. Now, Mitch, what is it about this genre, about Dracula, that has pulled you in as much as it has in your career? Because you're fascinated by this stuff.
Yeah, I am. And I don't exactly know. I think that every vampire movie is playing with these ideas of immortality versus mortality. So we think about that. Every vampire movie is about power struggles. Every vampire movie is about social structures. Who are our friends? Who aren't our friends? What group should we fall in with? What group should we stay away from?
Yeah.
All of those things are just enduring, deep, resonant questions that are handled by myth and fable. And vampires are legitimately part of myth and fable.
Do we know who actually invented Dracula?
Well, when Bram Stoker was doing his research on the book, he did discover Vlad the Impaler, who was a warrior some 400 years before Dracula was written, who fought against the Turks, who had a reputation of impaling his enemies, and he was sort of legendary, and there were stories of drinking blood and all sorts of things like that. So there was that. There was Countess Elizabeth Bathory, who lived around the same time, who believed if she bathed in the blood of virgins, she would stay young. And these were all times when these kings, these powerful lords, had complete control over the peasants. There was no law against killing one of your peasants. You could do that. That was part of what you got to be as a lord. That was your right.
Yeah.
And so there's also this question of social structures and predation. And, you know, it's no surprise that Dracula has this cape and he's fancy and he's this nobleman, who seems to be exploiting the people around him.
Let's go to a phone call here, 816-235-2888. We're talking about great vampire films. Lisa from Olathe. Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi.
Happy
Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday to you.
Okay, so here's one. Your show is kind of a blast out of the past for me now. For Jeffrey Tambor fans, 1981 comedy called Saturday the 14th. Has anybody seen it?
I think you've stumped the band.
I know.
Yeah, that doesn't happen very often around here. Yeah.
If you're a Jeffrey Tambor fan from Transparent and Arrested Development, you've got to check this one out. It's a spoof. It's I think it was probably PG. It's kind of has a Goonies kind of vibe to it. But Jeffrey Tambor plays the main vampire.
Have to check that out.
And it's quite funny.
Well, just for the record, Lisa, I can tell you, because I just witnessed it, that Aaron Hammerbeck was writing down the name of the movie.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You've made an impact here on the panel. Yes.
Awesome. I'm going to see it.
It may not be available digitally. I don't know.
All right. Lisa, I appreciate the phone call. Thanks very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye. Mitch, let's continue on our journey here as we review some of the great vampire films out there. You want to go right to a great one, Bram Stoker's Dracula from 92. This is Francis Ford Coppola adding a love story to the center of the novel, suggesting that Minna is the reincarnation of Dracula's long-lost bride.
So there have always been these Draculas that are dealing with ideas of, sexual attraction, and Dracula is this dashing figure who comes in, and Coppola takes that and really runs with it, with this idea of putting a huge love story at the center of the story, because in the book, at a certain point, Jonathan Harker has disappeared and his wife Mina is still, her fiance Mina is still back in England. Dracula shows up, and in the case of this film, they have this torrid affair that goes on through the center of the movie, which isn't really nice considering that she's waiting for her husband to be to soon get home. Mm-hmm. But that love never dies idea was sort of the big piece that gets added to Dracula. And that's part of the fun of adapting Dracula, is that there are often new things that get brought to the structure of the movie.
So even Francis Ford Coppola has made a Dracula film.
Yeah, and he decided he would make it like a silent movie, so they would do as many camera tricks, as many special effects in camera. They would make it all on a soundstage, all on the back lot, so it would feel like one of those 30s Universal kind of horror movies, except be in color and really bloody and rated R and all that, full of special effects. And so it's a really unique and interesting movie.
What's the clip we have here from Bram Stoker's Dracula?
This is a conversation between Dr. Seward, who is whose friend Lucy has been very ill. It sounds like somebody's been visiting her the night and drinking the blood from her, so he's confronting Professor Van Helsing on this very topic.
Those marks on her throat. No disease, no trituration. I'm sure the blood loss occurred there.
Oh? Where did the blood go? You were once a careful student, Jack. Use your brain. Where did the blood go? Tell me.
The bedclothes would be covered in blood.
Exactly. You do not let your eyes see nor your ears hear that which you cannot account for.
Something just went up there, sucked it out of her, and flew away, I suppose.
Yeah, why not?
Okay, that film again, Bram Stoker's Dracula. And again, that's high on your list, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
Okay, our final movie today. I hold it here in my hands. What Do We Do in the Shadows? It's from 2014, Aaron, and it's a New Zealand mockumentary.
Yeah, yeah, kind of. It sounds like, you know, Saturday the 14th is kind of in this genre of film that I always think of, like Dracula, Dead and Loving It. But this idea of making satire out of vampire films is not exactly a new thing. But this mockumentary is actually really funny. It's made by directed, written, and starring Jemaine Clement from Flight of the Conchords and Taika Waititi, who directed Thor Ragnarok. And it basically just follows the inevitable issues associated with a group of four vampires sharing a flat together. They're roommates and all of the issues that come with that.
Many of the jokes in this film are plays on other vampire movies, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's one of those things, you know, that they borrowed pretty heavily from Bram Stoker's Dracula, Interview with a Vampire, The Lost Boys, Nosferatu. And it's one of those movies that I think if you're familiar with vampire cinema, it's even funnier.
So that helps a little bit.
Get the jokes. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
We have a clip here from What Do We Do in the Shadow?
Wanted to have a quick chat about flat responsibilities because, guys, I think that we're not all pulling our weight here. We're not just pointing the finger at you, Deacon. You're a cool guy, but you're not pulling your weight in the flat.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that I'm cool.
No, that's not the point, though.
Yeah, you're missing it. No, not a flat meeting about how cool you are.
I do my flat chores.
No, you don't.
No,
yes,
don't.
I do.
That's why we're having the flat meeting.
The point is, Deacon, that you have not done the dishes for 5 years.
Vladislav is right. It's unacceptable to have so many bloody dishes all over this bench like this.
I'm so embarrassed when people come over
but
here.
What does it matter? You bring them over, you kill them. Yeah. Vampires don't do dishes.
So is that how you have to talk if you're a vampire?
I think so.
Is that the way it has
I
to
think
be
you
done?
You have to be.
Because if I had to imitate a vampire, that's what I would do,
you gotta
too.
You got to come from Eastern Europe, apparently. Yes.
Yeah. What was that clip you were listening to there?
Oh,
that
happens actually pretty early in the movie. You see them come together for a flat meeting where they start talking about responsibilities. And you actually see their countertop is just covered in blood-soaked dishes that have been hanging around for 5 years, apparently.
I think if you going to only watch one movie from this list, this is the one to
it's
watch.
So good.
Because, it's so funny. It's really one of the best comedies that's been made in ages, and it's clever, and they have, and it even, you know, embraces special effects that are suddenly surprising and delightful, and it's really great. It's a really good, funny movie.
The film, again, What Do We Do in the Shadow, right?
What We Do in the Shadows. Yeah.
Well, Mitch, we just have a few seconds left. Tell us a little bit about A Song of Love and Death. It runs through Sunday at Spencer Theater at UMKC. What are you trying to do here?
Well, it's a co-production between Kansas City Actors Theater and the graduate students at UMKC in their theater, the MFA students in the theater program, and it is a new reinterpretation of Dracula. Renfield is a woman, for example. We made certain changes within the text, but we've stayed really close to Bram Stoker's words and vision and story, and it's a huge production. I mean, full of special effects and huge cast, and it's really exciting, big old Victorian melodrama. So
we're going to see a little blood fly here.
There's a little blood flying.
Yeah, it's a vampire. It's a Dracula
there's
film.
Blood
here, right?
And bats and all sorts of good stuff. So come on out for Halloween, you know?
It's a good time of year to be doing it, next 4 days. Okay, again, that production, Dracula, A Song of Love and Death, and we're going out here today with some music from the 1979 film Dracula, starring Frank
Langella.
Langella. Okay. Okay, that sounds good. Laurence Olivier's in this too.
Right? He is. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you both for coming on. Aaron Hammerbeck, Mitch Bryan, thanks very much.
See you next time.
You bet. On Monday, more election coverage. Learn about Amendment 1, otherwise known as Clean Missouri, and the smart money experts look at financial planning for young couples and families. Always a good idea. Our theme music on this show is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Emily Reed. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.